That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now you listen to me, Hinchcliffe. It'll be for the last time. I'm through with your dirty rag, and I'm through with you.
You mean to say that Spike Kiley handed you out this assignment?
Well, I asked for it.
You asked for it?
Why not? It's a big story, isn't it?
You know what the big story this week was? I don't need to tell you. This is the Week in Review. I'm Steve Scher. Knute Berger is here. What was the big story this week?
Seahawks.
Of course. Tony Balter is here. What was from a news analyst with Bloomberg and other places.
And Seahawks.
Eli Sanders, assistant editor Stranger.
Seahawks.
Oh, I was wondering if you were going to just drop that. You did drop the level just a little bit.
You mean I butched it up for the...
I did not mean that. I did not mean that.
But
any way you want. Did you watch the game?
I did watch the game, yeah.
And did then you go to the parade?
I went to the parade, and I stood, you know, behind 12 people who I couldn't see.
12? Just 12? Come on, that's good. That's a good seat.
And I went to the celebration after the win, which was pretty fun.
Where did you go?
Pike Street, where people were just cheering and lighting a few small things on fire and shooting some fireworks and the most straight men hugging on Pike Street that I've ever seen.
Look what football can do. We should bring the football all
together,
all over to DC.
Well, one of the thoughts about the the night of the win in the U District, this there was some shock and awe about some burning couches. But isn't that how they get rid of furniture they don't want anymore in the U District?
Apparently, that is the way.
Or
bed bugs. Frat Row doesn't have bed bugs, does it? I haven't read that story. All right, you went downtown too, right, Knute?
Yeah, I did.
You were there with your family.
Well, my son, a bunch of members of my family went, but we were all separated by many blocks with no chance of seeing each other. But we tried to keep in touch by text until the phone system went down because you had 700,000 people sending photos.
Is that right? I didn't know that happened.
Yeah, the cell networks went crazy, so it took, like, I sent texts, and it took, like, a half hour to 20 minutes to get one text
through. Well, I couldn't get any texts through or any pictures through.
Well,
I mean, it was totally just jammed.
Yeah, the Times had a front-page story about it today, about kind of how that happened. And they were actually, at the end, they were asking people to stay off their cell phones because they were afraid that people wouldn't be able to dial 911. Yeah, it's sort of so much for a disaster, you know. If there's a disaster in Seattle, we're not going to be able to talk to each other for a while.
But you know what was really amazing?
It would bring us as much people downtown and excitement as that Seahawks did.
You know what was amazing, though? There were no, you know, major incidents at this event with 700,000 people. I was talking to some folks in the police department, and they were like, it was just everybody was mannerly except for a few, just a little pushing and shoving to get position. But other than that,
incredible showing of joy. It was really nice to see. And the largest gathering in Seattle history, is that right?
Yeah.
It was quite remarkable. So you wrote, well, let's start with the joy. What do you do with that joy, you know, the next day and the day after? Is it ephemeral or is it transformative? What do you think?
Well, I think that what you admit is that the city is in the best mood it's ever been in, you know, and it'll stay with us for some time. It's hard to know how long that lasts. You know, everybody was sending around stories that had been written, 36 reasons why Seattle's the coolest place ever. That was in the Huffington Post, and there was just a lot of glow. It'll last for a while. Super Bowls do that.
And then it will fade, but the memory of having been able to do it will stick. You know, there's something about never having won and then winning that is transformative, I think, and that will linger in the back of the mind even if we go back to losing.
I hope it kickstarts the Mariners would be one thought I had.
I've heard many people say that. Yeah. You have to have different ownership and different ideas. We'll have to talk about that. But what do you think?
Well, my answer to that, first of all, is there is joy. Enjoy it. You know, just enjoy it. There's so many civic occasions that when everyone comes together that are around tragedy, you know, assassinations, 9/11, the eruption of Mount St. Helens, the Nisqually quake. I mean, where everybody is focused and talking about a single thing. They're really rare when there are civic occasions where everybody comes around something that's just we're all happy. And I was amazed. I mean, that crowd, 700,000 people, it was talk about the mix of races, mix of classes, mix of people from here, people from Eastern Washington. I mean, it was just this, and everybody was there. It wasn't about politics. It wasn't about anything but celebrating the achievement of these athletes. And I think I think it is ephemeral, but I also think it helps kind of build towards something long term, which is people see the Seahawks, they see Pete Carroll, they see Russell Wilson. There's a model of success there, of perseverance and preparation and hard work and those kinds of things.
Sort of grace in accepting this big, huge victory. There's also a little ka-ching factor here because the businesses, this is going to be a good quarter for most the downtown businesses.
Especially people selling blue and green
shirts. All of that stuff. But their business definitely, I mean, those restaurants, were just coffee shops. They had a record day. They've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, I went to Pioneer Square. I saw there was a huge crowd, a line of people who wanted to get into the Jimmy John's for sandwiches. And the chef was at the door turning people away. We have no more bread. they were just sold out.
Here, just a reminder. You know, what was interesting, I was downtown, too, afterwards, and it was still packed. It was still raucous. People were still happy. Went into the Starbucks, which is right across from the City Hall. So it's a Starbucks that sees a lot of business, sees a lot of people anyways. But the folks had worked since 6 in the morning knowing that this was going to happen. They were still in good moods, the folks that had worked there. And they had worked hard, but they were caught up. They were swept up in it as well. And it is interesting. You said ephemeral but working towards someone. You talked about leadership. Here's something that Russell Wilson talked about.
And so our mindset right now, like we've been saying all year, is, as us players have been saying, what's next? And so our plan is to hopefully win another one for you next year. Go Hawks.
So isn't that interesting?
It's interesting, and some of the editorials and some of the columns were talking about so it went from, could this city win after all these years a national championship? It sort of shifted as that parade ended and became, the ending point for all of this, to will this be a dynasty? That's what you start thinking of. So do we have a next year? Do we have a couple next years?
And I think Knute touched on this in his column, and Danny Westneed also, and Charles Mudede in a good piece in The Stranger this week. But, we were mentioning grace a minute ago. There's also a kind of renewed sense of comfort with braggadocio, with declaring what we are rather than kind of shoegazing and hiding from what we are and can be, which is often the Seattle way. And so This kind of comfort with confidence, which we don't really see a lot here. Richard Sherman, I think, being the best example of that in the interview he gave that everyone talked about. But it will be interesting to see, and I think Knute was exploring this week, whether that sticks, whether this becomes a city where you can declare, I'm going to win, and then go out and win, and not have it seen as distasteful.
Is this a Northern, Finnish, Swedish, Norwegian notion? I mean, that's always been the sort of rap on Seattle. That comes from being a kind of a low-key, taciturn, don't put yourself out there, don't brag culture. Is that valid?
That's been an aspect of our culture, but it's really only been one thread. In other words,
Doc Maynard wasn't that way, was
it? Well, no, I was going to say Henry Hessler. No, and in fact, they were more like Russell Wilson. If you look at the history of Seattle and the people who built it, they were asking the question from the time they stepped ashore at Alki Point and declared this New York or New New York. They were asking, what's next? Why not us? Why not us? Why not? We will be the Pacific Ocean version of New York City or whatever. So I think there's a way in which there's a kind of confidence and it gets that hand gets overplayed. I mean, you end up with a kind of hubris,
and the New York
have
Jets.
This. Well, but also locally, I mean, it could turn into a sort of chamber of commerce boostery kind of mindless, type of thing. And so that's, I think, leavened by this other kind of more practical thing, which is the showing is in the doing.
Right. When there's no there. It's hard to brag. It's hard to be confident. But once you've demonstrated you have a lot to stand on.
Well, it used to be that if you asked somebody from Boston how they're doing, they would tell you what college they went to. Or if you asked somebody from New York, how are you doing, they would tell you how much money they had. But if you asked somebody from Seattle any of those kinds of questions, they would always downplay the money they had, the pedigree, because it was sort of a Northwest thing to kind of play that down. Put your plaid shirt on and don't and don't tout that stuff and don't act like those folks on the East Coast.
Yeah, that Joni makes a really great point, and that is this has always been a city, and it's interesting. I've been spending a lot of time looking at the history of this very thing of boosterism and whatnot. This city has gone through these periods where it's a city about youth and energy. When we built up an establishment, we were very quick to knock it down. When we built up a political system, we were very quick to knock it down. We want a very flat hierarchy here so that somebody like a Mike McGinn can be born on Long Island, come to Seattle, become mayor, and with almost no political experience. They didn't want to repeat the East Coast thing of calcification. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading an article in the Seattle Star, I think it was, from like 1912, this big article basically where the Chamber of Commerce and another organization split into two. And one was the Young Bucks, who thought all these other guys were holding back Seattle's progress. I think we're going through a period like that now and have been for the last decade or so, where you have a lot of young energy and money and high-tech skill and that kind of thing wanting to push the city in a different direction. And we are a city that allows that, that allows the reinvention, that allows the newcomer. And that often comes with a lot of that, why not us? What's next?
Well, that part about the politicians coming here, Norm Rice is from Denver, Slade Gorton came from the East. You know, that is absolutely true over time here.
You know, I was born in the late 70s here in Seattle to parents who had moved here in the early 70s, late 60s as part of that huge wave of people who moved to Seattle in that period explicitly to get away from the East, to get away from, you know, some of the things that Knut was describing, the rejection of materialism, status consciousness, cynicism. And my parents' generation and a lot of the people that I grew up with, their parents too were, you know, had gone 180 degrees the other way, earthy, idealistic, non-hierarchical, as Knut is talking about. And I think that's very, very real and comes in repeated waves of people coming out here and trying to completely reject the place that they're leaving. And it goes back to really the founding of the city.
So I'm in that generation too of your parents.
Right.
There can be some negativity to that if you forget the purpose of why people came and the roots of the place itself.
It can also get absurd, and then you get Portlandia. That's an entire show built around, you know, a culture that has become too impressed with its purely, you know, wonderful rejection of everyone else's, you know, failed strategies for living in life.
Well, there was a great Facebook post this week right after the victory. And this gentleman who was from Seattle for a period of time, actually from Oregon, but had moved to California, said, you know, I love Seattle. I really do. But it's going to be impossible to put up with that sort of egotism that's going to come. So we have to be careful because we also have a smug side to us once we start beating our chest around here.
Where have you seen that reveal itself in other places, that smug side?
Well, look, a Super Bowl makes people a little, I don't know, wild and crazy, and it should. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's just for how long and in what form it takes, you know?
I'll give you a smug example, is that we love to tout where we are on the list of cities that are smartest or best read.
Yeah.
I remember having this great lunch with a reporter from Le Monde in Paris.
Oh, really?
Downtown. Yeah, we were downtown and having this great lunch, and he was interviewing me about
snails. They're eating snails, I want you to know.
And yeah, no, I took him to like some Pan-Pacific place. It was great. We had a great lunch, and as you can only have with French people. And he said, you know, I think you are one of the most arrogant cities I've ever seen. You're always telling people how smart you are. Well, what that means is you think the rest of us are dumber than you are. And guess what? We're not.
Well, and
you are not the
French,
smartest city on the continent. You're not even, you know.
Wait, a French snob is telling us how to.
And no, but it was interesting because, in a way, he was just cutting right to that smug thing that you were talking about, which is, oh, how many books do we read? And how many, oh, we're so much smarter than everybody else. We're more livable than everybody
else. But it's kind of a double smugness or a smugness cut with self-awareness, of which there's a smugness about that, where we know that the things, or at least historically, maybe before now, if everything has changed now, which I doubt, but
everything has changed now.
Everything is different. The world is.
We're smug about things that we know that we care about and no one else cares about. So that's where you get, the literary city, the environmentally conscious city, the smarter than, the more intellectual city, maybe. And this now gives us something to be proud of that everyone does care about, football. And that's different. That's in a whole different category, and handling it, I think, will be different.
Well, just to that point, we got to get off lists, I think. The lists are for people who are insecure. Can I go see a list that says we're number one or two or three? We're secure now. We're confident. Get off lists.
Oh, now we're a world-class city.
Yeah, now.
We have an NFL football franchise.
There you go.
All right. What do you guys think? Especially that avoiding the smugness. I mean, what's the next step? And then where do people take this sort of good feeling? I'd love you to send us some emails, weekinreview@kuow.org. I'd like to kick those around in the next few minutes. So quickly compose, weekinreview@kuow.org. And we will continue with Knut Berger, with Eli Sanders, with Joni Balter on KUOW Seattle. We are reviewing the week, the news of the week, the events of the week, as we do every Friday on The Week in Review that comes your way at 10 o'clock on KUOW. Also, as a podcast, you can find it on our website. You can search for it in iTunes, Week in Review, KUOW. Knut Berger writes at Crosscut. He's also, what can I start calling you, like a historian of the city? There are many, but I'm calling you one too. And he's the author of Pugetopolis.
He's the unpaid historian, right? Yeah. He should be paid.
Yeah, you don't get it. It's not a city.
It's not a city job. Yeah,
there's no pension.
It could become one. Yeah.
I'll take one if it comes with health care.
Yeah, there you go. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger, Pulitzer Prize winner. Joni Balters is a news analyst for KUOW. She writes for Bloomberg and is the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel.
And you were one of the questioners.
Yeah,
we're
going to talk about that in our week in review extra that'll be on the record, but also a little later as well. All right. Just on that notion of, before we go to how not to be smug, let's be a little. You, Eli, were just mentioning what's happening on the Twitter and in the media coverage of Sochi.
Well, our meditation on smugness led me to think about the Sochi problems Twitter hashtag that's going right now, and it's also now a Twitter feed. I retweeted one or two of them, and then have been enjoying watching it. It is an incredible expression, among other things, of smugness, Schadenfreude, and a kind of what is wrong with you guys? You spent $50 billion on this Olympics. And some of the failures that are on exhibit in terms of the infrastructure are amazing. The water that you can't drink and also shouldn't put on your face, the hotels with no lobby, the feral dogs roaming around that either are going to be put down or saved by a Russian oligarch, who knows. The bathrooms with two toilets next to each other with no divider in between the toilets. You can
see
that's how
you become fast friends. Come on.
That's true. That's true. There are some amazing pictures of bathrooms with mirrored ceilings, bathrooms with toilet seats on upside down, incredible transliterated instructions or mistranslated instructions on how to use various things. Anyway, I recommend the feed. One of my favorite themes on it has been you know who would have thrown a good Olympics? The gays.
That's good.
When you persecute gays, when you do that and you make it inhospitable for gays, you should not be surprised that your hotels suck and your food is terrible and everything is kind of coming apart.
let that be a lesson to Vladimir Putin and the mayor of Sochi, who said that we don't have gays in our city.
Right.
Not anymore.
Right.
They all left.
The Olympics, you know, they haven't even done the opening ceremonies, and all this bad press is coming out. And if you look at those pictures that Eli's talking about, they are hysterical. And as Skip just said, one of the mistakes was not, they should have nailed down the journalist hotel maybe first, because now everyone, like, they all they have to do is lay in their bed and send pictures out of what's wrong. You know, there was this one room that I saw, it must have been on that same feed, that, you know, basically was a construction site, and then there was a bed in the room. And that was the journalist, you know, lodging for the amazing Olympics. Oh, my God.
There are other journalists tweeting about trading doorknobs that fall off for, for light bulbs that actually work. And some journalists from CNN tweeting about how they showed up. There were more of them than could fit in the one hotel room they were given, or however many hotel rooms they were given. They went off for a few days to work on a story. They came back and found other people assigned to their hotel room.
Oh, my gosh. That's like that part of Dr. Zhivago when they move into the house.
Oh, that's right.
And it's a little, you know, we're listening to journalists complain about their hotel rooms being substandard. I mean, there's something a little spoiled about that, you know, relative to the conditions of the world at large. But at the same time, Russia has made such a big deal about these Olympics and what it would demonstrate about the country. And so
this is a very fun tweet feed. Tweed would work.
Tweed,
Twitter feed. Tweed. Dave Mercer. Oh, it's supposed to be the Olympic Games. Easy mistake. Sochi thought they were hosting the Hunger Games. And then
easy mistake.
The Sochi Olympics will only feature four rings as to the normal five due to technical difficulties. That's some graphic that they've been having trouble
with. No,
that's
what happened this morning in the opening ceremonies. They lifted the giant display of five rings, but only four of them worked.
Yeah, that's right.
Only four of them lit up.
And then a bunch of, when the Russians were coming on, or a bunch of Austrians were coming on, they started falling on the ice as they were making their way.
So I did a story this week. Seattle, you know, has had this thing for years where people have said, why can't Seattle host the Olympics?
Bob Walsh has said that.
That's
over
right.
And
well,
over.
Yeah, and it was raised, you know, in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Last time it came up in any serious way, the city council smacked it down, said don't talk about that. Our name came up again in last spring. And Mayor McGinn asked people to look into it and see whether we should or shouldn't. So it's, you know, and so with the Seahawks thing, you may hear some renewed interest in this. Well, we actually did make an Olympic bid once in 1967. We bid for the 1976 Winter Games. We actually sent
Which
the mayor
ended up
of
in
Seattle.
Vancouver, British Columbia.
No, they ended up in Innsbruck.
Oh, that was Austria. The summer game, sir.
Yeah,
mayor of Seattle was sent?
The mayor of Seattle led a delegation, and the rationale for it basically was they were trying to do what people might want to do now with the Super Bowl, which is to keep the World's Fair spirit going.
Yeah.
They'd had this great success in 1962. How do they follow up on that? Well, let's get the Winter Olympics. So, delegation went back, made a pitch. We lost. We were competing against Denver and Lake Placid and Salt Lake City. And Denver got the right to make the official U.S. bid, and then Denver won the Olympics. But then the voters of Denver voted it down after the fact. And so they had to put it in Innsbruck. But the interesting thing, I just keep this short, but just the interesting thing about the bid was all the stuff we promised. We promised that people would be able to fly here on the SST. We promised that was supersonic transport that Boeing was building that never got built. We were promising to have mass transit. Because the forward thrust vote was coming up, guess what? We voted mass transit down. So, you know, there's a way in which you put your best foot forward in making these bids. And by the time the bid was reconsidered in 1970, Boeing recession. Well, the last person leaving Seattle turned. We could have been the Sochi of 1976.
Wow. We could have had feral dogs and hotels with no lobbies. And
instead, we got the Goodwill
showers.
Games.
Yeah, now,
remember
we did
that?
Get the Goodwill Games, and they demonstrated, I don't know.
Not that much, but well, they did put in that feral dog, you know, what they ended up doing was they took a lot of people they didn't like on the streets and put them on buses and sent them to California.
Well, I was going
to
say they demonstrated that we too could run something only.
Yeah, but you know, these Olympic bids get so heady, just like you're saying, they get so heady. You start promising things, and you have to do this sounds kind of dull, but you have to do the cost-benefit analysis. And usually what you're promising, you will not get back. And that's why we haven't really done it.
You know, to return to the parade that we were talking about.
Please, and then you'll love these emails, which I will share with you.
I can't wait. But it struck me how low budget and no frills and incredibly successful the parade was. That, you know, $50 billion, this extravagant ceremony to get, you know, I would guess something less than 700,000 people together, you know, for one day in Sochi. And here in downtown Seattle, you've just got football players on big flatbed trucks driven by the National Guard, little banners that someone printed up real quickly saying linebackers and whatnot. And that's it. The mayor is riding in Ride the Ducks vehicles along with the senator from Washington, Maria Cantwell, and Dow Constantine. I mean, it was very, very basic. And in a way, because of that, sort of intimate. Not a lot between the fans and the people that they really wanted to connect with and cheer and celebrate.
Yeah, I think I hit the mayor with a Skittle.
Good for you. I'm sure he tried.
You're that good of a shot.
Sure
Mr. Mayor. Well, I was pretty close. So,
all right. Here's some of your responses. Steel yourselves. Here's the other side of our boosterism. John, OMG, all this navel-gazing image, identity changing over a football championship, 3 question marks. What if even 200,000 sober people had come out to protest Inslee giving away billions to Boeing instead of schools or in support of machinists or something of importance and real meaning? My other argument is with the – actually, Karen wrote this. My other argument is with the numbers. Really, I think about 600,000 people live here. I know people came from all over, but – and then R.M. Grout – geez, you guys are positively anal about this. It was one football game. There's no dynasty. It just seems like much bigger deal than it is because the Seahawks were so inept for so long. Get over it and move on. Are you kidding? Seattle is inbred smugness. The whole state doesn't exist in comparison. My brother who lives in Seattle versus my Tacoma abode. What about the crime, etc.? Like Seattle is no crime. Seattle did such a good job with its smugness. When I visited Spokane, I was surprised at how big it was. That's from Beth.
This reminds me of, I don't know if you've seen on Portlandia, the recurring skit of the feminist bookstore. And the characters from the feminist bookstore live tweeted the Super Bowl. And this is kind of the same thing. If you read these letters in the voice of the characters from the bookstore in Portlandia, it would be perfect.
That would be very good. All right. One whole event with no scolds. How many concussions? Why do players earn so much? How many fans came to the parade using public transit? Blah, blah, blah. All right, one more. Interesting conversation. Two more. Interesting conversation on culture in Seattle. I want to comment on our innate need in Seattle to tout our amazingness. We, or at least I, feel the need to explain how we are good to those around us because underneath we have a heavy nerd culture. Some of the things we're good at aren't always considered universally important. They're good game players. As far as those pesky French, they only make comments because people don't like being reminded of their own faults. Even the French. They see in us the arrogance they know they have. That's why so many French love living in the Northwest. And
oh, mon Dieu, is what I would say to
a
that.
A thoughtful comparison to get us back on track for my question. I read the Stranger's article about Seattle stealing the mic. Julia writes, ended up meditating on Timothy Egan's portrait of Curtis capturing Princess Angeline's portrait. Seattle is at the crossroads of so many cultures and folks shedding traditions that residents have ended up in a mind space to be open to learn from each other, creating local synergy. Which is what we were dancing around with, and I like the way Julia put
there.
That.
Yeah.
So how does that connect that, if you will, for me, to looking at Paul Allen as this executive of this big team? And I know he's had his issues with other things he's run, but he seems to be lauded for his ability to manage by delegating effectively and giving resources. And compare that with Bill Gates. Now, yeah, this is my thesis for you. Now back as chief technology officer and a new president who, has that guy standing over his shoulder.
Well, these two co-founders of Microsoft have had very interesting, you know, lives as after they co-founded and went on to do different things. One of Paul Allen's dreams, he had many of them, and they were, you know, like the museum the Geary down there.
That museum thing, yeah.
That nice, museum.
The EMP.
What's it called? The EMP, thank you. And so you look at what these guys have come up with. Well, it was Paul Allen's absolute dream to have a new football/soccer field, which the soccer's surprised everybody with how successful that is. And now you know that it was his dream to create this dream team, if you will, and a moment that like he had this week, winning the Super Bowl. And you know, he kept saying, and giving it to the city. And how hip is that? He's playing music. You know, they all stayed up all night. You do know this story. The whole team was told by Coach Carroll to stay up all night Sunday after they won the Super Bowl. And I don't know if Macklemore was there, but Paul Allen was there playing the guitar. I mean, this is something that this is who he is. To go over to Microsoft, you want us to kind of address that there's a new chairman there, CEO there, Satya Nadella, and that Bill Gates is going to be sort of on the side, a little more time than he's been spending there. He's going from one-fifth of his time, I read, to one-third of his time to advise on sort of technical and products.
Yeah, cheap.
Which, you know, Microsoft's had a few not-so-Super Bowl moments with some of its products.
You were talking about leadership lessons there. The lesson...
You could bring Pete Carroll in if you'd like.
I'm gonna bring Pete Carroll, a listener letter, Bill Gates, and the state legislature.
Oh, you get an A.
You ready?
If you get there.
The lesson of Paul Allen and the Seahawks is that it takes a lot of money invested over a long period of years to produce excellence. The lesson of Bill Gates post-Microsoft in his work saving the world, basically, is that it takes a lot of money invested over a long time to produce results. And the letter from the listener who asked, what if we could get 200,000 or 700,000 people protesting the Boeing deal, I thought was very well put. And it's a point that a number of us on this panel would make ourselves, I think. And it would be nice to hear a Bill Gates or a Paul Allen say to the state legislature that you are moving in the exact opposite direction when it comes to, say, education. They are not investing over the long term with serious amounts of money to build excellence. They are doing exactly the opposite. And so if you want to take some leadership lesson that crosses the Seahawks, Paul Allen, and Bill Gates, perhaps it could be one that we would apply to Olympia and invest in our state in the same way that these men have invested in their companies and this winning football team.
Segway award.
That's why Eli Sanders is,
yeah, that's
is
why
the
he's
man.
Here.
Would you like to take on that, or shall I play a cut from Nadella first, Satya Nadella? Here's what he says about having this role.
We have the talent, the resources, and perseverance like no one else has. And then you take that and combine it with that fact that the world going forward is more of a software-powered world delivered in devices and services. I think we have the best platform to change the world.
Well, he's speaking the same language that Eli was talking about and that he'd like to hear from the legislature.
Well, you know, persistence is really key. Another thing is you are subject to whatever the times are that you're dealing with, and the change and the
Absolutely.
Factor of change. If you look at Paul Allen and the Seahawks, and I'm not ready to apply that as a model of how we should run the city by any means.
Or the legislature.
But if you look at he has had multiple attempts. He had to rebuild the Portland Trailblazers, had a lot of problems down there. The Seahawks, he needed, he's been through numerous management teams. He had to build a new stadium. He had to build new practice facilities. He had to go, it was a process for him. And he even said this of learning to build. You couldn't just put resources into something. You had to change the way you were doing it. And you had to change all the pieces. And the problem with something like Microsoft is you have a company that's been performing at a very high level that now has to change its tires without stopping the vehicle. In other words, Microsoft reminds me of the problem that newspapers have been going through, where your financial model is dying. Mm-hmm. The media environment, the technological and software environment is changing rapidly. You have to both be very adaptive to that, but you can't get rid of your legacy. And it's so complicated and so big what you're dragging along that it's very difficult to make those adjustments. So they've picked a guy who's really good at you know, has experience in the cloud computing and in areas that Microsoft wants to go in. He knows the company really well. Not so good. I mean, he doesn't have a lot of experience managing a company of that size and that kind of thing. And Bill Gates' own record of being able to find a succession to his leadership that worked is questionable. The Ballmer years are very mixed from a financial standpoint and other standpoints. And so there's an interesting way in which the Microsoft challenge is to build on this enormous wealth and experience that it has and infrastructure that it has, but adapt to an entire new business reality at the same time. And as we know with newspapers that got whacked by Craigslist and other things, that is really, really hard to do.
So here, we'll wrap that up with this idea of talk about leadership and approach and attitude. Richard Abulafia is an analyst we often quote in newspapers. He follows Boeing. He's been the go-to guy for media people when we want to understand what's happening at Boeing. He gave a speech, and in that speech, this is from the Seattle Times article about it, this is what he said about Boeing. "Congratulations," he said sarcastically. "They saved the cost of a 777 or two per year and lost the opportunity to work together with the workforce to be innovative and productive. That seems really foolish," he added. "If you don't have the workers on your team working with you, feeling good, you've lost a big chunk of the battle." I mean, Pete Carroll would echo that, right?
Absolutely. And you could apply the same criticism to the COLA increases for teachers that we've been putting off for years and years in Olympia.
That comment by him, can you say his name again? I believe
Richard Abulafia.
That too. That I have heard around town exactly what he said. Folks who feel they understand that Boeing needed to get some concessions, but sort of the way that they got them and the whole way that episode unraveled has left a definite bad taste in people's mouths. There's no doubt about that.
Well, they've alienated. Okay, and if you want to barf it, one too many Seahawks metaphors, but they've alienated Boeing's 12th man. I mean, well, they alienated a lot of the first 11, too. But
there you go.
But in terms of Boeing has always had a fan base in the Seattle community because so many families were part of the company. And when you suddenly say, we're no longer a family company, we're no longer going to exhibit loyalty to the people who got us where we are, even though we're making record profits, you are challenging a bond with a community that I think, as the analyst said, is penny wise and pound foolish.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll take a break with that. We'll come back and talk about what's happening in Olympia and the idea of downtown Seattle as a family friendly downtown. You're listening to The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. By the way, that's a little Joe Strummer from one of his albums, and this is International Clash Day, in case you were wondering.
I didn't prep for that. I'm sorry.
Why you're going to hear the Clash sneak up on you on this radio station. I'm Steve Scherr. You're listening to The Week in Review from KUOW Seattle. Knut Berger writes for Crosscut, is an author. Pugetopolis and other books. Eli Sanders writes for The Stranger. Joni Balter is a news analyst at KUW and works at, can I say you work at, work with, contributes to.
Contributes to.
Contributes
it,
to
yeah.
Bloomberg's.
Bloomberg View, the
Bloomberg
opinion side.
View. Mm-hmm. Bloomberg View. And she's also a host of Civic Cocktail on
Seattle
Channel. So we were there, you and I. Talking to Ed Murray, and Knut was in the audience. Eli was recovering from his festive dancing in the streets.
He was recovering from that segue, which was just.
And you were talking to Ed Murray, and of course he had the glow of that parade and
so much glow,
Seahawks victory. But you asked him about, I think, his first 100 days.
Yes, and he had a lot on his agenda.
He has a lot on his agenda. And the question one question I had for him, which I didn't ask, but you kind of did, and I'm wondering how you would answer that, is, so what's he want to, or what will he be able to actually point to?
For his
not 100 days at the end of the year.
I'm going to do the 100 days first, if that's okay. So he comes into office and he declares $15 minimum wage.
Is a good idea.
As an executive order for city employees. He just sort of says, I'm here, I'm doing stuff, boom, he does that. He then goes on to the police department, and there have been so many changes in the top command. And at the same time, the city council comes along and passes that arrangement whereby a new chief can come in and bring their own command. That's a change for us. And then he has committees galore. Oh, my gosh, does he have committees? Committees studying whether Seattle will go to a $15 minimum wage. It will eventually over time.
Over time. We heard that from a number of people.
We heard that from a number of
people. Over time might be 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, but it'll be approved by this summer is what I actually think. He also talked about, addressing the fact that the seawall is over budget. He definitely deflected. He is not taking on Bertha at this moment as a city cost priority because of all that. He wants to deal with the Department of Neighborhoods. He just had you heard him. He had so many things he wanted to do in 100 days. So maybe your question was right. It'll maybe take the year to get to some of those.
But you think he has a structure in place and a working relationship with the council to accomplish?
Well, think about that as well. So 5 members of the city council endorsed him. So instead of the scenario we had 4 years ago with the city council already pea shooting at Mike McGinn, you have 5 people who are invested in him. They endorsed him. They're rooting for his success. We don't know what they're sort of overlooking just because they're sort of on the team. How long that lasts, who knows? But that is the setup.
Another example of this is when it comes to crime. I mean, there's the police department shakeup. But do you remember last year when we spent so much time talking about whether there was a surge in crime in downtown Seattle, what the murder rate was relative to previous years? We were watching every next shooting to add it on to this running tally. Well, here we are in February, and just the beginning of February, and there have been a number of shootings in Seattle. There have been, I think, at least a couple homicides, and we don't see a kind of adding them up in the same way that the Murray campaign was so focused on doing when it was trying to get him into office.
The Murray campaign and the media.
Yes, true. Sort of with the flames fanned by the Murray campaign. And there's an obvious reason why they wouldn't be doing that now. But when you ask the question, you know, what will we be looking at the end of the year or even at the first 100 days, I would suggest that someone go and add up the number of violent crimes and homicides in Seattle in this first part of the year and just see where we're at.
I hear Mike McGinn saying, yes.
No, I mean, Eli's absolutely right. There have been a lot of shootings. I don't know that they were actual homicides, but there's been a lot of shooting. I mean, read the paper and see that.
Yeah.
And so it's just very, very striking that we're not treating these events in the same way that the Murray campaign suggested they should be treated when they were campaigning, which is to create a running list and a sense of crisis.
And you don't have city council members calling press conferences to say, this is unacceptable.
Right. And it never hurts to have a winning football season. It really doesn't in terms of coverage. You know, one of the other things we heard at that civic cocktail on the Seattle Channel, you can watch it, is this discussion of creating a family-friendly downtown. And that just brought to mind past efforts to create to create a family-friendly downtown. And you said you were reminded of something you saw too, right?
Well, I just remember back in the Royer administration, back in the 80s, Seattle had this problem of lots of families leaving. They didn't like busing. They didn't like the way the city was going. The city declared itself a kid's place, and these signs went up all over town. Seattle is a kid's
place.
With
the K spelled backwards.
Yeah, the kid's handwriting thing. And it was kind of like everybody knew it wasn't true, but it was like if you say it will become true. And I was just saying I remember like, I don't know, it was like the year 2000. There was still one of those signs up under the viaduct,
I think you can still find them around.
Yeah, it's probably still there. But this issue of downtown being it's already parts of downtown, Belltown, for example, are already the densest in the city. More families are coming down, more young kids are coming down, and they're trying to show to the school district that they have the kinds of growth rates in young people, that they deserve a school downtown. So there's a real discussion about how do you get downtown to be family friendly.
I was struck by the statistic. I can't remember it, but
Kate Jonka.
Kate Jonkas of Downtown Seattle Association gave. There's a lot of kids that live in downtown.
A lot of little kids, a lot of births lately, and just sort of bigger numbers than, I can't remember them exactly, but bigger numbers than you would expect of school-age children, which is really interesting to go back to that Royer campaign, because while those signs went up and for many years thereafter, you know, Seattle would always come in number two to San Francisco as the most kidless place per household. So with the way the census measures that is school-age children in households. And we had a huge, like in the 80% of households that did not have school-age children. And so, you know, now it is maybe changing, and especially downtown. And so this discussion the other evening was aimed at sort of how do we push that? How do we make downtown more family-friendly? Not to be too fixated on the Seahawks, one way is to empty out all the schools for a downtown parade for the old Super Bowl.
It was interesting because I wrote this piece on the history of condos in Seattle, and the people who were living downtown in the 60s and 70s were old poor people. That was primarily, you know, old retired dock workers and whatnot, people living in apartments and whatnot in Belltown. When the condos went big and were built in Belltown and First Hill, the people who moved in were mostly older rich people. And that has been a dominant, a big piece of the market downtown has been either second home apartments for, you know, well-to-do people or people moving back from the suburbs when they retire and getting a downtown place. But now they're seeing a shift to younger people, people starting families. And the key thing with that demographic is you're seeing this from 0 to 5 years old, you're seeing a ton of growth. The trick is keeping them after they go to kindergarten.
Right.
How do you get 6 and 10-year-olds and 12-year-olds to live downtown and feel safe?
And one part of that is the push to build a public elementary school in South Lake Union. I think when you were talking about downtown as a place for old people who were done working, especially the Belltown area, kind of the suburb of that center is South Lake Union, where so that's a downtown suburb of downtown where you have families, people who want to start families with young kids, and they will be kept there if they can have a public school nearby.
Well, can I just add to that? When we talk about downtown, the interesting thing that I see happening is that people are changing their definition of downtown.
It's moving north.
It includes South Lake Union. So if you push on the folks who were there the other night to say, public school, where would it go? Do you really mean like heart of downtown, or do you mean South Lake Union where all these tech families live? The answer is close to Denny, so it would serve both, of course. There also has been talk, I don't know how far it's gotten, but there has been talk of a private K-12 downtown from a for-profit organization. I think it's called GEMS. I think I was told it was called GEMS. Now, that's an international or a national group that's looking around different cities and hasn't really committed here yet, but they were sniffing around.
Here's a great email from Michael. Minneapolis has some public/open enrollment schools downtown that allow commuters and those downtown to enroll their kids close by. Cool idea. I mean, that is an interesting idea, isn't it? To shift the way parents can get their kids.
We do that with daycares, but not with the kindergarten and up.
And that was the other thing we heard from Tim Burgess and others in this notion of creating a family-friendly downtown. A public interest in pre-K. Mm-hmm. Can the city do that?
Well, yeah, I think the city can do it. And certainly, I mean, the state's talking about doing it, but certainly the city can if it wants to, if there's the will. You know, it's interesting. There are other cities that have tried versions of this overseas. I think in Copenhagen, they offer free daycare to people who live in Copenhagen. In other words, to reduce commuters and get people to live in the central area, they actually offer free daycare if you live in the city. And I suggested 10 years ago or something that Seattle consider doing something like that. And I think, you know, if you get to universal pre-K, you create a lot of opportunity for doing that kind of thing that then Seattle becomes a magnet as opposed to a force of pressure outward.
And that creates opportunity because the other thing they talked about in this making a family-friendly downtown was affordable housing. How are you gonna keep people who have a kid and they have two jobs but they don't have great-paying jobs living in a city, let alone living downtown? That's an interesting benefit that maybe you'd ask the citizens as a whole to contribute to.
Well, yes, and you have to somehow integrate your housing planning process with where the kids are going to school. In other words, you have to be able to build housing near schools. Also, the existing schools, as well as building schools near existing housing that's family-friendly housing, meaning more than a studio, more than a...
Not apartments. They won't fit.
Not initially. All right. Well, those are interesting topics. I'm sure we're going to follow that. I found that whole idea of a family-friendly downtown and the folks who are leading it interesting. I hope to, at least if nothing else, see where they would put a school and what kind of parks they think the city would want to see downtown. Knute Berger is the Mossback at crosscut.com. He also writes for Seattle Metropolitan Magazine. I almost had that.
Seattle Magazine.
They're down there. They're cursing me. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter is a news analyst for KOW, and she hosts Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. You can watch that show and see some of the things that those folks were talking about. Luke Burbank is out of town, but he's still hosting LiveWire tonight through the magic of radio, so do check that out at 8 o'clock. We will talk to you guys again next week. Thank you all.
Thank you, Steve.